Oh my goodness, oh my goodness. Holy shit, has it really been since February since we've had a chat? Damn, that's ridiculous. Well, I must say it's been a ridiculously busy couple of months with work and family, but it was all positive, just busy. But I'm back. And if this is your first visit or your 37th visit, welcome to Women Committing Crimes. I'm your disembodied voice, Tammy, and I am so happy you are joining me today. This is a podcast about, you guessed it, women who commit crimes. We'll have a chat about women throughout history who have committed the gamut of crimes for extremely violent murder, Catherine Knight, so gross, to prostitution, Hi Heidi Fleiss, to bank robbery, stick-em-up Laura Bullion, to drug lords, godmother of cocaine, Griselda Blanca, human trafficking, shame, Chang Shuping, to insider trading, Martha, and fraud, Elizabeth Holmes, stand up and be counted. These are just some of the crimes I have chatted about, but there is so much more I have to talk about, sorry, and so much more I have talked about. And adding to that gambit today is spy. But before we unveil our woman today, I want to remind listeners or inform you if you're new that the PS section, postscript where I do updates, will be up front here, and I put the feedback section at the end. I'm trying to have less lead-in, of course, with the exception of today, obviously, so we can get right to the head of the podcast without too much housekeeping. That way, if you're curious what other listeners have said, or you want to hear a shout-out to yourself from me for your feedback, just hang with me until the end, and I'll sum it up with feedback. I have some great feedback to add at the end of today's podcast, so stay tuned for sure. Now, for the PS section, of course, the WCC that has the most interest still is Elizabeth Holmes and her guilty verdict. And I have an article I'm going to share with you here, and it is from Insider Newsletters, and it's written by Ryan Hogg, May 29th, 2022, so just the other day. So the title of the article is Elizabeth Holmes Pleaded with a Judge to Overturn Her Theranos Conviction, Citing, quote, insufficient evidence. So let's find out what the judge said with that. Elizabeth Holmes, I'm going to read directly from the article, it's just easier that way. Elizabeth Holmes has pleaded with a judge to overturn her conviction for wire fraud, with her attorney saying there is, quote, insufficient evidence for any rational juror to proceed with the conviction, according to court documents filed on Friday. In a 24-page filing, lawyers for the Theranos founder targeted her conviction of wire fraud, arguing the evidence provided did not amount to a guilty verdict. Quote, because no rational juror could have found the elements of wire fraud and conspiracy to commit wire fraud beyond a reasonable doubt on this record, the court should grant Ms. Holmes' motion for judgment of acquittal, end quote, they said in the filing, which was first reported by Bloomberg. Holmes was convicted on four fraud-related charges in January, linked to investments made by hedge fund manager Brian Grossman, the DeVos family, and the former Kravath attorney Daniel Mosley. She was acquitted on four other counts of wire fraud, while jurors couldn't reach a verdict on three other counts. Holmes is due to be sentenced on September 26th, with each of the charges carrying a maximum prison term of 20 years and a $250,000 fine. She was charged alongside former Theranos president Ramesh Sunny Balwani, whose trial is ongoing. In the latest filing, lawyers for Holmes said there was no evidence of Holmes and Balwani conspiring to commit fraud against investors. They wrote, quote, even if Ms. Holmes committed wire fraud against an investor, she did not. That's their words, not mine. And even if Mr. Balwani committed wire fraud against an investor, that does not prove a conspiratorial agreement between them, nor does it prove that Ms. Holmes willfully joined any agreement, end quote. The attorneys claimed that only one of the hundreds of texts shown to jurors was linked to representations of an investor, Rupert Murdoch. But, quote, but, again, that message, offered through an authenticating witness unable to provide context, provides no inkling that Mr. Balwani and Ms. Holmes were conspiring to defraud Mr. Murdoch, end quote, they said. Holmes dropped out of college at 19 to start Theranos, which attracted a $9 billion valuation at its peak. Her journey was depicted on the Hulu drama The Dropout that starred Amanda Seyfried. I hope I said that right. Theranos' technology was found to be flawed with a 2015 Wall Street Journal investigation by John Carreyrou, I hope I said that right too, triggering the company's downfall and lawsuits from her biggest backers. Holmes' lawyers argued the investor fraud counts relies heavily on the testimony of whistleblower Erica Chung, but that Chung testified about failures of Theranos' results before Holmes promoted a later version of its analyzers, the Minilab, to investors. Investors with whom Theranos partnered were focused on the long-term goals of the company and its ability to impact healthcare in the future, they said. A judge will hear Holmes' appeal in July before the September sentencing. The attorney's office of San Francisco could not immediately be reached for comment outside of normal working hours. So that's the article about Elizabeth Holmes. So she's trying to get off on that technicality that, you know, was it on purpose? You know, the conspiracy to commit wire fraud? Or, you know, was it just always accidental, sorry kind of thing? I don't know. All the reading and all the updates and stuff I've done with her, I don't know. She's pretty crafty. And, you know, again, I'm not on the jury and I didn't see all the evidence and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, guilty, why not? It's a good thing I'm not on the jury, right? So that was the update on Elizabeth Holmes. There's no other updates really that I can find. Most of our subjects so far are dead, so not much there. They're still dead. There's an update. Or they just don't change a lot, like in the last year or so. And Martha Stewart is so high profile. I mean, that one's fairly easy to understand what's going on with her. All right. So now that we've caught up a bit, let's get to the good stuff. Since our woman today is a famous spy, I think it's important to start with a little history of espionage. We all like a spy story, for sure. I mean, that's what makes, you know, 007 what it is, right? But where does that come from? All right, often called the missing dimension of history, espionage is defined as the practice of spying or of using spies, typically by governments, to obtain political and military information. It probably dates back to the beginning of humanoids, but is traced back at least to the Egyptians, you know, as far as like history is concerned, because I'm sure they had spies in prehistory. Got to see who's, you know, chasing which herds of animals. Anyway. All right, so traced back at least to the Egyptians, as well as the Hebrews, who had spies that were documented in the Old Testament of the Bible, if you read that type of thing. In particular, Joshua 2, 1 through 24. The chapter starts out, quote, "And Joshua, the son of Nun, set out of Shittim two men to spy secretly, saying, 'Go view the land, even Jericho,'" end quote. The Greeks and the Romans, of course, used spies, especially the Romans, due to their extensive empire. They needed to know what was going on, especially with, like, their garrisons and stuff that were as far away as, you know, the British Isles. They needed to know, make sure there was no rebellions. But in the 4th century CE, Sun Tzu, and I'm probably not saying it right because it's Chinese, he was a Chinese general and military strategist during the Eastern Zhou period, wrote The Art of War, in which he is quoted as saying, quote, "One who knows the enemy and knows himself will not be endangered in 100 engagements," end quote. Sun Tzu defined differing roles of spies, such as the secret agent in place, or what's called the informant. There was also the penetration agent, not what it sounds like, it's actually the undercover agent, that has access to an enemy's leaders. And then there is the disinformation agent that feeds a mix of true and false information to point the enemy in the wrong direction. Also in the 4th century, to move on to other parts of the world, well, not too far away though, Chanakya or Kautilya in India wrote the, I'm trying here, so I'm going to take this slow. I should have gotten pronunciation for this, but Arthashastra, or the Textbook of Statecraft and Political Economy. In it are detailed accounts of intelligence collection and covert operations as means for maintaining and expanding security and power of state. In the 11th century CE, King David IV of Georgia, not the state in America, but the country, you know, in Asia, who ruled from 1089 to 1125, used spies called the Mustavaris to uncover feudal conspiracies through counterintelligence. The Aztecs, to move on to the Western Hemisphere, used Pochtecas, who were in charge of commerce in the Aztec Empire, but also worked as spies and diplomats. Another group evolved from the Pochtecas called the Quimichan, who were secret agents working undercover among subjugated peoples to spy for any groups planning to rebel. By the way, pronunciation guides for ancient Aztec is not easy to find, just saying. During the Elizabethan Age in England, Francis Walsingham, created more modern espionage methods, including the use of cryptographers, to keep Mary Queen of Scots from deposing and assassinating Queen Elizabeth I. George Washington used a network of spies during the American Revolution. The French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars used extensive networks of spies. Spies were used on both sides of the American Civil War. A lot of women in that, by the way. I have a really long list of that. Both world wars made use of spies, and some would say that World War II was won by spies. And that's where, like, a lot of the famous ones. And, of course, the Cold War. The Cold War glamorized spying and espionage with a barrage of movies, think James Bond, as well as TV shows. These are all old, but I know there's more newer ones. But for those of you my age and older, think Mission Impossible, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and even Get Smart, right? Beginning in the Cold War and continuing after into today's world, sexpionage was and is often used, using men and women, more women actually, but men also, in the involvement of sexual activity or the possibility of sexual activity, intimacy, romance, or seduction to conduct espionage. This is often what's called a honey trap. I'm sure it was used way back before the Cold War, but that's when the cool name was given to it, so... And that's also, you know, what you see in the movies and TV shows. It's, you know, the femme fatale woman who's you know, trying to get information from the man. But they use men, too, because there are, you know, women agents. And so they use men to seduce them and get information as well. Or men with men and women with women. I mean, whatever works, right? And the use of women as spies is documented as far back as the Middle Ages. I even have a book about that that I'm going to read just to get some more, you know, women on here. But I'm sure they were used before that and it was successful, and that most men for a long time, and still some assholes out there, did not believe women were smart enough or tough enough to be spies. Well, World War II for sure proved that was false. And even, like I said, the American Civil War, but we'll get to some of those women later. By World War II, for sure, women were known to be some of the best spies the world has ever used. Unassuming, smart, and thought to be uninterested. Men are dum-dums, and they speak in front of women, talk to mistresses, wives, servants, etc., not knowing or believing these women would be spying for the enemy. Yeah, like I said, dum-dums. And today, we are chatting about one of the most famous of these women spies, using what, well, she was accused of using sexpionage, and that is Mata Hari. So let's jump right into this, and I did my best as far as pronunciations for some of these things, but I am going to use a recorded one for one of the things that I have to talk about. Anyway, so Margaretha Gertruida Zell was born August 7th, 1876 in Leeuwarden, Netherlands, to Adam Zell, a hat shop owner, and Antje van der Meulen. Leeuwarden is a city and municipality in the province of Friesland in the Netherlands. It has a current population of 123,107, but when Margaretha was born, the population was under 1,000. But, interestingly, in 2018, the city was awarded the title European Capital of Culture. I could not find out why. I didn't take the time to do that. I apologize. I will go back later and maybe that'll be an update. But I'm kind of curious now that I'm thinking about it. I wonder why. Anyway, Margriet, as she was called by her family, and what I'll call her for now, was the oldest of four children, with the other three being brothers, the two youngest brothers being twins. Margriet was treated like a princess by her father. I mean, only girl, right? When she was young, he would buy her fancy dresses. On her sixth birthday, he bought her a Bulkenwagen, which is a child-sized carriage pulled by a goat, and the picture is adorable and hilarious at the same time. Adam Zell loved attention and to show off, and spent way more than he ever made, and as we go through this, you'll see that, you know, apples don't fall too far from the tree. He made several investments, some in the oil industry that never paid off, and unfortunately went bankrupt in 1889. That was right after that, Magritte's parents divorced. The separation was scandalous, because divorce was not common and was rarely granted in that time. Antje and the children lived in a rundown apartment until the bankruptcy was finally posted publicly, and then 3 days later, Magritte's mother died. Magritte was about 15. So, did she die of broken heart? Possibly. Did she die of embarrassment? That's possible, too. But I didn't find out how her mother actually died. All right, well, the family fell apart. and the boys went to live with Adam Zell and his new wife, Magritte was very hurt that the father that she adored and that had spoiled her most of her life did not want to take her in, but it was probable that Adam's new wife did not want to deal with a spoiled, you know, daughter, Magritte. That would be competition for, you know, resources. Instead, Magritte went to go live with her aunt and uncle, Visser. Now, there was another source that said it was her godfather, so I'm just going to call him uncle for now, because most of the sources that I used, he was actually an uncle. Anyway, she was not well treated there. In fact, they told her that she would probably never find a husband, which, you know, by telling a girl that in the 19th century is awful, because that's what girls did, was basically found husbands, right? But they told her she would never find a husband because she was flat-chested, which, by the way, haunted her whole life, and I'll get to that later. She was dark-colored, too tall, her family was disgraced, and she had no dowry. So, a dowry, by the way, is defined as property or money brought by a bride to her husband on their marriage. So this, to me, seems an ancient ritual of the patriarchy. Like, here's my daughter, right? Here's stuff that you'll get if you marry her, instead of just banging her and possibly knocking her up out of wedlock. Because if you get knocked up out of wedlock back then, and even in some circles today, that makes you worthless, and you will never be able to get married. Which, of course, again, all that is the patriarchy, and I'm not going to even get started. Because, you know, ugh. So anyway, they sent her to a boarding school to be a kindergarten teacher in Leiden, which was famous for the Leiden kindergarten method, which was a method of teaching that encouraged children's natural love of learning through play rather than sit and listen lectures, which we kind of all start out that way. At least, I don't know what kindergarten's like now. And I actually was changing when my son was in kindergarten, not so much when my daughter was, but when my son was, to where back when I was in kindergarten, kindergarten was mostly just play. You learned how to play with other kids, how to share, that kind of stuff. So it was fun. And then by the time you start getting into the upper grades of elementary school, it starts becoming not as fun because that's when they start making you, you know, sit in the desks for sure, and you can't move it. All that kind of stuff. And this to me, this kindergarten method kind of sounds a little bit like what a lot of Montessori schools are kind of like. You know, it's more of a hands-on thing. And research has shown that that is, even for high schoolers, that it's much more preferable for the kids to learn than just sitting in straight rows and listening to, you know, teachers drone on and on and on. But, you know, what do I know? I've only been doing it for 24 years. Anyway, back to Magritte. It was rumored that Magritte and the headmaster of the school, who was an acquaintance of her uncle, had a sexual relationship. She was 16, and he was 51, and married. Magritte was sent home in shame, because, of course, it's the girl's fault. She was blamed for the disgrace, but not the creepy pedophile. And her uncle shipped her to The Hague in 1893 to live with another uncle. So we'll get to that in a second. But to go back, so she's the one that's blamed for this. Instead of this, you know, supposedly, you know, respected headmaster. I wonder how many other females that might have happened to just at that school. I mean, obviously, you know, it happens everywhere, but it that kind of thing is just such crap. Anyway, The Hague is the administrative capital of the Netherlands, by the way, and since the invention of the United Nations after World War II, it hosts the International Court of Justice, or World Court, which is one of six parts of the United Nations. It settles disputes among other countries in accordance with international law. It also hosts the International Criminal Courts, which is an intergovernmental organization, which is also the first and only international court with jurisdiction to individuals for war crimes, looking at you, Putin. For war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, again, looking at you, Putin. When Magritte was 17, she answered an ad in the newspaper that a Captain Rudolf MacLeod of the Dutch colonial army had placed looking for a bride. It was actually placed by a friend of his, a journalist friend of his. They got drunk one night, and, you know, his friend posted that as a joke, but it worked out, I guess, kind of, sort of. The ad said, quote, "Officer on home leave from Dutch East Indies would like to meet a girl of pleasant character, object matrimony," end quote. He was 21 years older than Magritte. Yuck. Anyway, they wrote letters for a long time before they actually got married. He called her Greet or Greta, and she called him Johnny, which was a family nickname. So from now on, well, for now, I'll change and start calling her Greta, and I'll call him Rudy, because Johnny is confusing. So I'll just call him Rudy. She signed all her pre-marriage letters, quote, your future little wife, end quote. They finally met in person March 24th, 1895. It was an instant attraction. Greta began signing her letters, quote, your future little wife who loves you already, end quote. They became formally engaged 6 days after they met, which in 19th century Netherlands, a formal engagement was legally binding. In some of her letters, she sounds as if she is in love. As an example, quote, you ask me if I'm longing to do crazy things? Well, Johnny, rather 10 times than only one. Go on, you know, in several weeks I will be your wife. What luck that we both have the same ardent temperament. Actually, they really don't. No, I do not believe either that all these pleasures can ever end. This gets gross. Yes, my dear, I wish very much to wear everything that you find beautiful. The rose silk suits me very well, because I am so brown and have dark hair. Surely I find these nightgowns beautiful. Pardon my ignorance, but tell me, should such a chemise end above or below the knee? I will make sure that they are very low cut. And the underdrawers, should they be the same style as my white ones? Ah, how we will play! Be amorous, my treasure, for I will be also, and be strong when I come to you. End quote. This letter sounds flirtatious and cute and kind of gross coming from a woman and loved her fiancé, but remember, she's only around fucking 17, 18 years old, and he's like 38. It's just, you know, I know times were different, but it's still kind of gross. Just saying. All right, before the wedding, Greta did have a few doubts and asked Rudy if they were moving too fast. His reply, quote, I thank you for your very sweet letter, but I'm sorry that you have any doubts. Let these go and trust in me completely. Trust in me like a rock, and I promise you on my word of honor as a Dutch East Indies officer that I will love you and protect you without reservations, my darling, end quote. A word here really quick about the Dutch East Indies, which is actually modern-day Indonesia. Indonesia was a Dutch colony that started as trading posts for the Dutch East India Company. The Dutch East India Company, or the United East India Company, or, this is where I'm going to play a pronunciation from the internet.
Verenigde Oost-Indische Compagnie.
That's actually, they used VOC for short for that. You can see why now I use the internet for that, because there's no way in hell I was going to try to pronounce that. Anyway, it was a multinational, excuse my coughing too, by the way, was a multinational corporation, and it was founded by a government-directed consolidation of several rival Dutch trading companies in the early 17th century. So it was basically, they had all these different rivalry companies, but then the government was like, hey, if y'all band together, we can spread out and colonize even more. Yay, more money for everybody, more power. They were a rival to the British East India Company, which did the same thing like in India and parts of Southeast Asia and that kind of stuff. So this was like at the height of imperialism and colonialism, you know, that we're talking about here, you know, the 19th century. So anyway, Greta and Ruta got married. Rudy, sorry, not Ruta. Rudy got married July 11th, 1895. Rudy wore his full dress uniform, you know, with the braids and all his medals and that stuff. And Greta wore a vibrant yellow silk full-length gown with a train and full-length veil. There were 2 bridesmaids and 2 groomsmen. Now, the groomsman I get, he's probably got buddies, right, in the military. But I wonder who the 2 bridesmaids were. Throughout all my research, every single part of it, there is not one girlfriend that they talk to. There's not one that goes, oh, I remember Greta back when she was back in, you know, at the school. Oh, yeah, I remember her, blah, blah, blah. Not one. So I wonder who the 2 bridesmaids were. Maybe they were cousins or something. Because, yeah, all my research, there's, like, no word from anybody that was, like, close to her, really. She didn't seem like she'd had too many female friends. They would probably be competition, you know, and I think maybe that's part of it. Because there are some females out there that don't have even female acquaintances. Now, later on, she has a servant girl, but that's not the same. Anyway, Rudy's sister Louise was at the wedding, his younger sister, and he warned Rudy not to marry Greta. I mean, the age difference alone, right? Greta's father, Adam Zell, who was not on the best of terms with her at this time, but came to the wedding, but he did not go to the reception. He was actually going to go to the reception, but Greta and Rudy gave the carriage driver the wrong address on purpose, so he never showed up. Anyway, they honeymooned in Wiesbaden, a popular spa town in Germany. Greta later said, quote, We went to Wiesbaden and we lived like people who can spend 100,000 guilders in 1 year. I love luxury. It was just the right thing for me. I was proud of him and he of me. We do what we wanted, end quote. This is pretty much basically what her attitude is for the most of her life. Why not? You know, if you can get it, grab it. After the honeymoon, the couple moved in with Rudy's sister because they spent a lot of money, so Rudy's broke. They move in with Louise, the one that didn't want him to marry Greta. Rudy was out on sick leave. It was probable, and it was in most of the sources that he had had syphilis in his life, but not sure if that's what. I don't think he's out on sick leave for that here, but I don't know. It doesn't really say. None of the things really said about this one. He was only pulling like half his pay at the time, and come to find out, he also had a ton of debt. Regardless of how it looked like they lived it up in Germany. He was also a hard drinker, so she finds out all this stuff when they get back from the honeymoon and have to move in with his sister. So the marriage was already showing issues this close to the honeymoon. Greta was no housekeeper either, and she definitely was not frugal, and she and Louise did not get along. Greta later said, quote, "Well, it, the marriage, did alter from the moment there was no more money, of course. I had not married to go without luxury, and I was flirtatious, and he did not like that. He was jealous. He was much older than I am. He could have been my father. And then, a woman with my temperament, I want to confess truly and openly that seeing a handsome young man made my heart start to beat quicker, and that is very natural. That is something one can't help. I was very temperamental. I had also artistic aspirations. I had inclinations that made it impossible for a woman like me to be a good housewife. I was not like that at home. I confess frankly, I wanted to live like a colorful butterfly in the sun rather than the calmness of the inside of my room," end quote. Well, at least she figured out who she was by that time. She doesn't become who she was right away, but, and to make it worse and to add to the double standard of the time, and this time as well, by the way, Rudy might have been jealous of Greta's flirting, but he was shagging other women 2 weeks after the honeymoon. So, you know, goose and gander situation, right? Rudy and Greta did some shagging of their own, though, because January 30th, 1897, Greta gave birth to her first child, a son, Norman. Rudy was then told to move to Malang, Java, so he goes back to work. Java is one of the islands in Indonesia and was a major part of the Dutch East Indies. Malang is a landlocked city in the province of East Java. Rudy, Greta, and Norman left on steamboat SS Princess Amalia on May 1897, and Greta was 20. They moved several times in Java, so much moving, but at the beginning, she had no problems with Java. She kind of enjoyed it. Rudy was promoted to major. They moved into this giant house with verandas all around it. You know, those big tropical plantations that you see pictures of? That's what they moved into. So she, by then, became a woman of luxury and high rank. Then she, in May of 1898, their daughter Jean-Louise, who they called Non, was born, and I'll call her Non also. In September of 1898, the Dutch East Indies were celebrating the coming of age of their Queen Wilhelmina of Holland, which is the Netherlands. She was the daughter of William III. He had died when she was like 3, so her mother was regent, and then when she turns 18, she takes over. She's actually pretty interesting. She had kept, they loved, she was beloved because she had kept the Netherlands neutral. During World War I. World War II, she escaped to, I believe it was Great Britain, but definitely the Allied side, and then because of the German occupation, and ran a exiled government from there. But anyway, so some men in the battalion at this celebration that Rudy commanded wrote a musical called The Crusaders. I couldn't find very much about it, but anyway, Greta starred in the theatrical production, and it was a huge, huge hit. The men especially were just all, you know, gaga over this. And Rudy was not happy about all the male attention Greta received for her performance either. Especially, you know, the young men. As time went on, though, Rudy's alcoholism became even worse. He became abusive to Greta. He often blamed her when he was passed over for promotions, and he openly had mistresses. But looking this up, this was not uncommon for Dutch East Indies officers. Even if they had families in the East Indies, it was just, and really for the 19th century, that's not uncommon either. In May of 1899, Rudy was transferred to Medan Sumatra in the Dutch East Indies and left without Greta and the kids. Eventually, and there was a lot of hard times. He wasn't sending money. She had to go through Louise to ask him to send money. And anyway, eventually they did join Rudy, but the marriage was pretty much almost destroyed. Then, tragedy struck the McLeod family. In 1899, both the children became violently ill. They were both vomiting like this weird dark liquid and had severe stomach pains. And unfortunately, on June 27th, 1899, two-year-old... Now, they are babies. On June 27th, 1899, two-year-old Norman died. The doctors thought it was poison, and it probably was. There's, you know, conspiracy theories about how they were poisoned by a servant that hated Rudy or hated Greta. It doesn't matter, and possibly just food poison. Or they might have had congenital syphilis because Rudy had syphilis back in the day. And if they had congenital syphilis, then maybe the treatment was actually worse than the syphilis. Who knows? Nobody will know because Rudy said no to an autopsy, which kind of is weird. But I guess, you know, the idea of cutting up a child to find out what killed them is very, you know, heartbreaking. Rudy blamed Greta, of course, and she blamed Rudy. Luckily, Non, the daughter, recovered. She does die later when she's only 21, and I'm not sure why. I didn't really find, you know, why that happened, but she does. Anyway, after Norman died, or 1921, I'm sorry. After Norman died, Greta, who was now speaking to her father again, wrote to him about her life with Rudy in the Indies at that time, and it's terrible. So before, it was great, and then Norman dies, and then now it's not. Even it wasn't great. I shouldn't say that, because remember, Rudy's still alcoholic and abusive and has mistresses, but, you know, for the most part. But here it changes. Quote, "More than ever, I am longing for Holland. Good Lord, what a lot of problems and sadness in my life, and why all this? How could one be worried about a rank and a name when one is so deeply unhappy? Don't think that I have a good time with such an old, severe man who does nothing other than watching me, punishing me, and telling me 100 times a day that I am inferior to him, that I should be happy with his name and good family, family who do not even look at me and behave as if I don't exist. I really have no life. He has all the money in his hands, pays for the milk and the meat, and only gives me what is needed for the market, a maximum of 50 cents a day. And if I want to buy needles or thread, then I have to beg him for 10 cents. He doesn't give me clothes because he is afraid that I will look too good. Oh, I can't really bear it. And if then, And if then you see all these young lieutenants around me who are always so amorous, then it is very difficult to behave so that they can't reproach me, that he can't reproach me. Let me read that line again. Sorry. Anyway, I can't really bear it. And if then you see all these young lieutenants around me who are always so amorous, then it is very difficult to behave so that he can't reproach me. Thus, the Indies is a typical country. Isn't Holland the same? This morning he was looking again for a brawl, so he thumps into me, and last week he hit me with his cat-o'-nine-tails because he thought that I had painted myself. It wasn't true. My lips are always that red. It is impossible to stand the situation any longer. In a moment I will go to his office, and I will propose to him that we get a divorce. I will study theater in Amsterdam, and I may become something, but this I don't want any more. Goodbye, dear parents. Maybe it is better for Norman that he is resting in his grave and does not know what he has been saved from. I do not know one happy person that would wish this fate on." Obviously, end quote. Obviously, she is not happy with Rudy or the Indies anymore. Sorry about the flubbing. I practiced it, but, you know. The translation from, I'm pretty sure, from Dutch to English, there's some weird grammatical and mechanical things there. Anyway, Rudy was not happy with her either. His words were harsher about her, for sure. Quote, "A scum of the lowest kind, a woman without heart, without love of anyone, who cares nothing for anything, and who never thinks of my love of the little boy, and doesn't speak of him ever," end quote. So Rudy was very close to his son, even though he was only two, right? He loved him, but he gave him more affection even than he did Non, probably because he was a boy. But the weird thing is, in all the sources, Rudy never speaks of his kids by name. He never calls his little boy Norman. He never calls his daughter Non. He calls them the little boy or the little girl. He doesn't even say my little boy, my little girl. He says the little boy, the little girl. I find that weird. I find it kind of, you know, he was probably attached to them, but it sounds very detached. Anyway, they didn't part yet. In March of 1900, Greta got typhoid. So that kind of keeps you from, you know, asking for a divorce. Then in October of 1900, Rudy was discharged from the military service. Now, by that time, he's aging, right? The family moved to a remote village. Life only got worse. Greta was isolated. Rudy became even more violent and brutal, even threatening to shoot her with his pistol on occasion. But then finally, in March of 1901, they moved back to Amsterdam. August of that year, Greta filed for divorce, but Rudy proposed a reconciliation, mostly because he was broke, and it's cheaper to keep her. They moved back in together in November of 1902. Of course, it didn't last. And this is kind of weird in and of itself, but they negotiated that Greta would leave and leave behind Non with Rudy. She said that he was an abusive husband, but a good father. So they became legally separated, which is important. But it is kind of strange that, maybe not, but I mean, she left her daughter with her husband, which, you know, frees her up. She loved the children, you know, when she was a mother, but it's just kind of strange. Anyway, Greta moved to Paris in 1903. She said, quote, "I thought all women who ran away from their husbands went to Paris," end quote. In Paris, she reinvented herself and claimed to be a widow of a Dutch East Indies soldier trying to support herself and two kids. But no one really cared, so she tried acting. That didn't work. The only viable work she could find was pleasing men for money. That's a lame way of saying prostitution, but I only found that in one source, so I'm not sure how much of that is true. But that source also says when Rudy found out, he threatened to have her committed. So Greta moved back to the Netherlands to live with Rudy's uncle, which is weird too, and that did not work out. So she moved back to Paris in 1904. This time was different, though. This time, she used her imagination and her innate talents. She moved into a good hotel, knowing that, hey, I'll get some money to pay for it. She got a job with an equestrian circus, which is interesting. However, she actually was a better dancer for the circus than a rider. She had developed a series of sacred, exotic dances that she said she learned in the Indies. Quick note here on the difference between exotic dancing and erotic dancing, because as we move further into Greta's story, they might seem interchangeable, and in some instances they are. But according to the 2004 edition of Merriam-Webster Dictionary, exotic dancing is defined as strikingly, excitingly, or mysteriously different or unusual. The definition, according to the same source, of erotic is relating to or dealing with sexual love. So, exotic dancing can be erotic, and erotic dancing can be exotic, and that's pretty much what Mata Hari did. And as an etymological fun fact, exotic comes from the Greek exo, meaning outside, and erotic comes from the Greek god of sexual love, Eros. So, there you go. Greta created a mythology about herself, wore revealing costumes, adopted the name Leda Grecia MacLeod, who claimed to be the widow of a Scottish officer in the Indies, where she learned the dances and claimed that the dances were holy. She said, quote, "I never could dance well. People came to see me because I was the first who dared to show myself naked to the public," end quote. She knew. She knew sex sells, man. That's all there is to it. She often took off her veils and danced, being naked except for a brass breastplate. In most of the pictures that you'll see of her, that's what she's wearing. And it is kind of attractive. But here's the thing. One of the reasons why she did that was she was very unhappy about her breasts. You know, thanks, you know, on an Uncle Disser, who had told her breasts were too small. Which that, even if that was your godfather and godmother, uncle and aunt, doesn't matter. Why are you telling her anything about her breasts to begin with, now that I think about it? Excuse me. So she always wore the breastplate because she was always embarrassed because she thought her breasts were too small. But, you know, there's lots of people out there that like small titties. So I don't, you know, I feel bad for her that, you know, she kind of doesn't live in today's society because, you know, she'd make a killing for sure. Most of her first performances were private. Madame Gorivsky, a society hostess who favored new artists, had Greta perform in her home. And this is wonderful. Francis Kaiser, a reporter for the London Society magazine, the magazine's called The King, he gushed about the performance that he saw. So this is the way he writes, this is amazing. Quote, "Vague rumors had reached me of a woman from the Far East, a native of Java, wife of an officer who had come to Europe, laden with perfumes and jewels, to introduce some of the richness of the Oriental color and life into the satiated society of European cities, of veils circling and discarded, of the development of passion as the fruits of the soil, of a burst of fresh, free life, of nature in all its strength, untrammeled by civilization. The door opened. A tall, dark figure glided in. Her arms were folded upon her breast beneath a mass of flowers. For a few seconds, she stood motionless, her eyes fixed upon a statue of Shiva at the end of the room. Her olive skin blended with the curious jewels in the dead gold setting. I think it's supposed to be head. A cask of worked gold upon her dark hair, an authentic Eastern headdress, a breastplate of similar workmanship beneath the arms. Above a transparent white robe, a quaint clasp held a scarf around the hips, the ends falling to the feet in front. She was enshrouded in various veils of delicate hues, symbolizing beauty, youth, love, chastity, voluptuousness, and passion. The first notes of a plaintive, weird melody were sounded, and with slow, undulating, tiger-like movements, she advanced toward the god. It was an appeal to the spirit of evil, an invocation to help her avenge a wrong. Her eyes shone with the fire of revenge when she began, but after a while, a softer light crept into them as she strove to win the favor of the deity. Then the movements became more and more intense, more feverish, more eager. She first threw flowers and then divested herself one by one of the veils, implying that, as a sacrifice, she gave beauty, youth, love, etc. And finally worked to a state of frenzy, unclasped her belt, and fell in a swoon at Shiva's feet." End quote. Oh! Can you picture it? He was a great writer. I can picture it. And it's very exotic, very erotic. You know, that would be very exciting to see, I think. Regardless of who you are. Because of these theatrics, she was invited to dance at the Musée Guimet. The full name in English is Guimet National Museum of Asian Arts. It was founded by Émile Étienne Guimet, who was an industrialist who manufactured artificial ultramarine, which is an incredibly beautiful deep blue pigment. It's the blue pigment that they used during the Renaissance for, like, you know, any of that bright, almost electric blue. I suggest you Google it. It's beautiful. Anyway, the museum opened in Paris in 1889. Guimet had been commissioned by the Minister of Public Instruction in France to study religions of the East. The museum contains collections of Chinese and Japanese porcelain objects and items from ancient Egypt, Greece, and Rome, as well as things from Southeast Asia during the colonial period. Greta's dances fit right in. It is said that Guimet was the one who suggested she acquire a more exotic name. Greta chose Matahari, which means Eye of the Day in Malay. Mata, I'll call her that from now on, said, quote, "In the beginning, my career was less in the artistic domain, but from the moment that I introduced my Javanese dances, my fate was quickly decided. I liked life there. I received protection of the richest strangers, and I did not lack the skill to profit from that. At the time that I appeared on stage in Paris, I chose an Indian name for the theater, and in daily life I used the name of my husband. People who thought that I was English or Scottish, I left them under that impression. At this moment, I enjoy my passion for theater with full rein. More than I could ever think, I see now that all success depends on attendant circumstances. I was pretty, and the people, the men, they love a pretty woman. They like to see much of a pretty woman until the border of the indiscreet. I have never been afraid to catch a cold. Remember my décolleté, that's low necklines on dresses, which my husband tried to forbid. Well, then I started to use décolleté more and more. With every veil I threw off, my successes rose, pretending to consider my dances very artistic and full of character, thus praising my art. They came to see nudity, and this is still the case. I act as thousands do. I speculate on sensuality. I behave coquettishly and flirt now and again with a full house. That came easily to me. That came always easily to me." End quote. As an aside here, that artistic thing, by getting the press to call it artistic, really makes a difference from keeping her from being arrested, basically, for indecency. So she's not just some, you know, stripper that comes to a to a party or whatever, she's this elegant, exotic erotic dancer. And so with that being holy dances, that kind of stuff. And luckily, again, as that newspaper man wrote it, by writing it that way, it becomes artistic. And once if it's art, it's not indecent. Oh, humans, that's funny. Anyway, the museum was packed the night she danced. There were over 600 people, which included artists, musicians, writers, aristocrats, intellectuals, officers, diplomats, ministers, bankers. Between dances, Mata Hari spoke to the audience, with her words being repeated by her in French, English, Dutch, German, and Malay. So keep that in mind. She does speak all those languages. Quote, "My dance is a sacred poem in which each movement is a word and whose every word is underlined by music. The temple in which I dance can be vague or faithfully reproduced as here today. For I am the temple. All true temple dances are religious in nature, and all explain in gestures and poses the rules of the sacred texts. One must always translate the three stages which correspond to the divine attributes of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, creation, fecundity, destruction. By means of destruction toward creation through incarnation, that is what I'm dancing. That is what my dance is about." End quote. So, yeah, Buddhism, obviously. Hinduism, for sure. Like, those are gods within the Hindu religion. So that does make it, again, not indecent, according to the authorities. By 1905 and 1906, Mata Hari was the most popular dancer in Paris. There were postcards made of her dancing. They're absolutely beautiful. Word of her was spreading through Europe. She often gave contradictory stories of her past to the press, which just intensified the mystery around her. Her most popular origin story that she told was that she was born in a sacred Indian temple and was taught ancient dances by a priestess. She loved every minute of this, by the way. She was mingling with the famous and infamous of the time and gave exotic dancing respectability and erotic. In 1906, Rudy wanted to remarry. Remember, they had only been legally separated. He was embarrassed by Mata's fame because, there's your wife looking amazing, doing amazing things, and everybody wants her, and you're just sitting back like, whatever. Anyway, so he used blackmail, nude photos, that kind of stuff, to get a divorce, and he got full custody of Nun. His grounds for divorce were, quote, that she had carnal knowledge of other men and by consequence rendered herself a culpable adulteress, which is the motive for divorce. Thus again, that's the double standard. Men can fuck around with as many women as they want, even when they're married, but a woman, obviously she had lots of lovers. Let's say what it is. But if she would have only had one, it still would have been grounds for divorce. She can't divorce him for him fucking around, but he can divorce her for doing it one time. So again, that double standard of patriarchy. Anyway, back to this. So the next one, that the defendant who lives actually in Paris produces in the aforesaid city the cafes, concerts, and the circuses, and there executes the so-called Brahmanique dances and presents herself almost entirely nude. That she also posed entirely nude as a model for a sculptor, and this work of sculpture was offered to public view. That these facts must qualify as indecent extravagances, end quote. Well, the divorce was granted April 26, 1906. I can't imagine that she would be upset about that. I mean, she wanted a divorce for a long time. So for her, it was probably like, yippee, goodbye, motherfucker. Anyway, she had many lovers, like I said, including Emile Etienne Guimet. And in 1905, she went to Berlin, where she became the mistress of Lieutenant Alfred Kiepert of the 11th Westphalia Hussars. He set her up in an apartment and maintained her luxurious lifestyle for her. Quote, "I remained 3 years with him. He set me up in Berlin. We traveled a great deal, and because he was very rich, he kept me sumptuously," end quote. His wife and family eventually made him ditch Mata, but he gave her over 300 German marks, which is about $1 million today. Yes, she blew through it, but that's not the point, right? Now, we're going to jump through the timeline pretty quick here because it's all the same stuff. She's dancing, she's got lovers, she's doing her thing back and forth between France and Holland and so on. She's being who she is. So we're going to jump to 1908. She was over 30 at this point. Veil dances were becoming commonplace and popular with younger women. So she decided to go to Egypt to learn new dances. And then in 1911, she tried to get her daughter back, but She even tried to have had a had a servant try to kidnap her, but Rudy was there on the spot, so she gave up on that. In 1914, so we're gonna, like I said, start jumping through a timeline here because we need to get to that spy part. In 1914, Mata went back to Berlin and became the mistress of several men, including Alfred Kiepert again. She was dining one night with the chief of police in Berlin, Herr Grebel, and it was in late July 1914. So get your mind set here. The Austrians had just invaded Serbia. Quote, "We heard a noise of a great disturbance. This demonstration was certainly spontaneous, and Grebel, who had not any warning of it, took me in his car to the place where it was held. I saw an enormous mob that was giving way to a frenetic demonstration in front of the Emperor's, that's Kaiser Wilhelm's, palace and shouting, 'Deutschland über alle!' Germany over all. Several days later, war was declared. At the time, the police were treating foreigners like animals. Several times I was stopped in the street and transported to the station because they were convinced I was Russian." End quote. So, which war was this? World War I, the Great War, the war to end all wars. Of course, it was not called World War I at the time. It didn't get that label till World War II. World War I began July 1914 and ended November 1918. For the century before World War I, nationalism, which is defined as the identification with one's own nation and support for its interests, especially, this is the part that makes it nationalism, especially to the exclusion of, or detriment of the interests of other nations. So nationalism had been growing as a response to imperialism and colonialism. Countries have been taking sides with each other, gang-like, for about 100 years, creating a complicated network of alliances. By World War I, the major alliances were the Triple Entente, which was France, Russia, Britain, and the Triple Alliance, which was Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Italy. So these countries had also been beefing up their militaries over the last 100 years, post-Congress of Vienna, which convened after the defeat of Napoleon to restore the world order of monarchy and empire. World by here, by the way, does not include USA, but did include South American colonies. So, as a handy acronym for causes of World War I, you can use to impress your friends: militarism, alliances, imperialism, and nationalism. It's main. So there had also been several revolts around Europe in the 1830s to the 1850s, and a little bit past also, which just made tensions like build up even worse. So tensions in Europe are ridiculous at this point. And the U.S. is, a fledgling country going through their own parts, whatever. So, with this giant powder keg just sitting there, along comes a Serbian national named Gavrilo Princip. He lights his powder keg by assassinating the Archduke Ferdinand, the heir to the Austro-Hungarian imperial throne. So, what that does is Austria now declares war on Serbia. Russia declared war on Austria because Serbia is their bro. Germany now declared war because Austria is their bro. Think Habsburgs, right? Which you'd think that Russia and Germany would be friends because the Tsarina of Russia, Alexandria, was from the Habsburg family, but whatever, we all have that outlying family member. Then, because Germany declared war on Russia, France jumps in and says, "It's on, we can do it." Then Great Britain says they have to jump in because they are Great Britain. You gotta puff out your chest when you say that. And God damn it, the sun never sets on the British Empire, so fuck yeah, we're involved. So now the infamous gang war of World War I is on. But wait, Tammy, you are saying out loud. I know they aren't part of the story, and I know it seems arrogant to always include the USA in all stories, but my mind has been brainwashed with American exceptionalism, and I need to know how the US got involved with World War I, truly making it a world war. Too damn bad. I'm tired of talking about them. Let's leave them out at least one story, so you can Google that if you really want to know. But Mata Hari's more interesting, so let's get back to her, back to Europe. So where does that leave her, right? She's now in the midst of World War I. Well, the Netherlands was neutral during World War I, which we can give credit to that to sweet young Queen Wilhelmina. Since Mata Hari is Dutch, she supposedly could travel freely across the European borders. But in Berlin, she was having issues. She was already kind of on a watch list, and I'm not sure why, but the British already put her on a watch list. The Germans are kind of suspicious of her because even though she's Dutch, she has an address in Paris, and she wants to go back to Paris. But the Germans confiscate all her stuff. They kick her out of her apartment. The banks froze all her accounts. And what little stuff that she was allowed to take, she packed up and took a train to Switzerland. But the train was stopped People were searched, and she was kicked off the train because she opened her big mouth and said she was headed to France. So actually, she lost all that stuff too, because it was left on the train and she was kicked off. So now she's broke and homeless. Still, right? In Germany. She goes to Herr Grebel, the police officer, the chief of police that she was having dinner with the night that, you know, war broke out. And he would not help. So she eventually found a Dutch businessman who helped pay her way back to Holland. There's not much else to that. When she gets to Holland, she reestablishes a relationship with a former lover, Baron Eduard Wilhelm van der Capellen, a colonel in the Dutch cavalry. So he took care of her financially for a while. Then, again, we're going to jump forward to 1915. Mata was visited by a Karl Krump, the honorary German consul in Amsterdam. His job was to recruit espionage agents for Germany. He offered Mata 20,000 francs to join his organization. She at first said, that's not enough money. And he said, okay, well then go on this mission. If you're successful, we'll give you more money. Her code name would be H21. She took the money. He had given her some invisible ink, you know, to pass the messages back and forth. You know, all that kind of cloak and dagger cool stuff. But she said that she didn't like that idea, so she dumped the ink out and kept the 20,000 francs. Why not? So she returns to Paris in 1915. She had left a house behind there. That was one of the places, you know, she wanted to get back there before. So she goes to Paris from Holland to get her stuff from that house. And the ship she's on is stopped at Folkestone, England. There she was questioned along with other passengers. She said she was going to Paris to sell her stuff. She then told a Captain Dillon of MI5, the spy, you know, organization, that she was moving from Paris to The Hague to be with her lover, Baron van der Capellen. Dillon's notes said, quote, although she was thoroughly searched and nothing incriminating found, she is regarded by police and military to not be above suspicion, and her subsequent movements should be watched, end quote. Suspicious, yeah. So from this point on, she's for sure on the list, on a list. But suspicious probably because she's an attractive woman, even though she's a little bit older, she's an attractive woman, traveling alone during wartime, which is kind of weird. For that day. Women travel alone all the time now, but during wartime, you know, in Europe, that's kind of strange. Also, she spoke 5 languages. She was from a neutral country, which means that she can go back and forth, supposedly, right, with her papers. And she was bold and considered immoral for admitting to have a lover. You can't be that. What that does is it attracts attention to yourself. And that's exactly what she did. So from that point on, for sure, she was kind of watched a little bit because she had been with Germans and she was trying to get back. But for sure, British counterintelligence and espionage unit kept track of her travels from this moment on. 1916, Mata was back in The Hague. But by June 1916, she went back to Paris and lived her normal, luxurious life. Again, all the back and forth. That's also very suspicious, by the way. During wartime, you know, it's like one of those, okay, well, just because you are Dutch and part of a neutral nation doesn't mean you should be traveling all over the place. She did notice that 2 men were always following her. They were Paris inspectors Tarlet and Monnier. They followed her from June 18th, 1916 to January 13, 1917. While in Paris, Mata met 3 men that would heavily influence the rest of her life. The first was a lover, Second Lieutenant Jean Halour, who was well known to MI5, which added even more suspicion to her, because he was suspected of being like a double agent kind of thing, and she was trying to get him to help her with a task I'll talk about in just a second, which he refused, but anyway. The second was also a lover, but Mata would actually fall in love with this kid, and I do mean kid. His name was Captain Vladimir Maslov, better known as Vadim. He was 18 years younger than Mata, so he was like the age her son would have been. He was part of the Russian expeditionary force that was sent to France to help fight on the Western Front. Now, his role in this, unbeknownst to him, really. The third man was Captain George Ladeau, and I'm getting to, you know, Vadim's role here. Mata wanted to visit Vadim, who had been wounded and sent to Vittel, a spa town near the front, to recover. He had been shot down. I guess he was a pilot. Lost an eye. But anyway, people from foreign nations were not usually allowed to go that close to the front, especially neutral nations. Why would you, if you're a neutral nation, why do you want to go to the front? That's kind of suspicious. I'm just saying. So she had to get a pass, and Ladeau was the man to get it from. But Mata did not know that Ladeau was also the head of the Douzième Bureau. The Douzième Bureau means second bureau of the general staff. Okay, so it is France's external military intelligence agency from 1871 to 1940. It developed intelligence concerning enemy troops. It was criticized, and I'm going to go through this very briefly. There's so much more to this, but it was criticized for, where was it? Its involvement in the Dreyfus Affair and was looking to redeem itself. So, in a nutshell, December 1894, Captain Alfred Dreyfus, a 35-year-old cavalry officer who was Jewish, was convicted of treason due to false evidence that he had revealed French secrets to Germany. He was falsely convicted and sentenced to life in prison on Devil's Island in French Guiana. Devil's Island was a French penal colony that operated between 1852 and 1853. The death rate at that prison was like 75%, partially due to the climate, because it's in South America. Abuse. Obviously, because anytime you have a prison on an island, guess what? And then, of course, disease. French Guiana, by the way, is in South America and borders Brazil and Suriname. Anyway, new evidence came to light that it was a different guy that did it, but because of anti-Semitism, that guy was acquitted because some higher-ups were anti-Semitic and suppressed the evidence. The good news, though, ultimately, was that Dreyfus was eventually pardoned and released. He fought valiantly in World War I and died in 1935. But the case divided France and was an embarrassment for the Bureau because they did not, I guess it was an embarrassment because, they did not discover that evidence had been suppressed, and it was just, it's complicated. Again, I just kind of wanted to fill you in as to what that Dreyfus thing was. So back to Ladeau and Mata. So Ladeau was also the guy, by the way, who had hired, who had Tarlet and Monnier follow her. She did not know that. So she goes to him and asks for a pass to Vatel, so that way she can go see, her lover, this young kid, Vadim. Ladeau asks her to spy for France for the pass. So spy for us, and you get the pass. And she agreed. She got her pass. Vadim asked her when she got there. Vadim asked her to marry him, and she accepted. And then now she's like, oh, I need more money because I gotta support this kid and me, and all that. So before the war, Mata had performed several times for the Crown Prince of Germany, Prince Wilhelm. He was the son of the German Emperor Kaiser Wilhelm III. Prince Wilhelm was the last Crown Prince of Germany, by the way, because the German Empire obviously is dismantled by the end of World War I. So the Bureau wanted her to become lovers with the Crown Prince, go back and say, hey, remember we used to, and then that way she could get secrets from about Germany and pass it to France. So she had to meet up with the Crown Prince. So she goes to Madrid, Spain. There she met with German military attaché Major Arnold Collier. I guess Kale Collier. He had been sent to the German embassy in Spain in 1912. He was responsible for maintaining military political relations with Spain. She asked him to arrange a meeting with the Crown Prince. And then in return, she would give Germany French secrets, also in exchange for money. In November 1916, Mata was on a steamer headed to Paris from Spain. The steamer was stopped at British port of Falmouth. There she was arrested and taken to London. This is just kind of like a precursor of what's going to happen later. She was questioned by Basil Thompson. He's head of Metropolitan Police CID, which is Criminal Investigation Department. He played a key role in arresting wartime spies. So she admitted to working for the Bureau. For the French. And she even asked Ladeau for help, but Ladeau denied knowing her because he thought he was going to get in trouble for hiring someone the British was suspicious of. But the British go ahead and release her. They are infamous, by the way, for releasing spies. So anyway, so they release her because, let's see what happens, is what the British are kind of thinking, right? Unfortunately, from here, both France and Germany start setting traps for her. They realize that she actually had no information and was more a liability than an asset. In fact, she was labeled what's called a fool spy, which means they know that she knows nothing, and now they have to find a way to liquidate her. They can't just, shoot her. They have to have her incriminate herself or somehow. So, December 1916, the Bureau let Mata obtain names of six Belgian agents. Five were suspected of submitting fake material while working with the Germans. The sixth was suspected of being a double agent for Germany and France. Mata then left for another trip to Madrid. 2 weeks later, the double agent was executed by the Germans. The other five were left alone. In reality, she didn't pass on any information nobody knew. The Germans already knew about the Belgians, and the French knew they knew. So the Bureau now thought she was spying for Germans, and it ended up blaming her for like 50,000 deaths for this incident. In January of 1917, Major Colley, sent radio messages to Berlin where he described the helpful activities of a German spy codenamed H-21. The Bureau intercepted the messages, you know, the French. Collier had sent the message in a code that the Germans knew the French had already broken. So General Walter Nikolai, the senior intelligence officer in the Imperial Army, he was sick of Maude Hari. He felt she only gave him gossip and no real intelligence. So they send that out to see what the French will do, because they know the French have already broken that code. So they're setting her up. February 1917, Ladeau had Maude Hari arrested at Hotel Elysee Palace. This, by the way, is the official residence of the President of the French Republic, so that's Macron's official home. It was completed in 1722 for a Louis-Henri de la Tour d'Auvergne, the governor of Ile-de-France. Anyway, so France was looking for a high-profile trial. They were looking for a scapegoat to make them look better, basically, you know, because of that Dreyfus trial. And, you know, all the people that had died, even though it was their fault. So they were pinning that 50,000 deaths on her. And Germany basically just wanted her out of the way. She was a liability. So she was placed in Saint-Lazare prison while awaiting trial from February until July. She became very sick in prison. This prison is just, you know, it's a women's prison and it's terrible. She was attended by two old nuns, but otherwise she was kept in isolation that whole time. And this is a woman who, you know, feeds off of the attention of others. She was questioned for 17 hours in 17 separate sessions by Pierre Bouchardon, nicknamed the Great Inquisitor. Unfortunately for Maude, her lifestyle worked against her. Remember, this is a bold, sexually strong woman in the early 20th century. That's not going to go well for her. Maude was put on trial on July 24th. Bouchard said her whole persona was a sham, so that proved she was dubious and dishonest. Quote, her long stories left us skeptical. This woman set herself up as a sort of Messalina, the sexually voracious wife of Claudius I, dragging a throng of adorers behind her chariot on the triumphant road of the theatrical success. She appears to be as one of these international women, the word is her own, that's his words too, who have become so dangerous since the outbreak of hostilities. The ease with which she expresses herself in several languages, in French especially, her innumerable affairs, the flexibility of her finances, her style, her remarkable intelligence, her immorality, born or acquired, all contributed to make her suspect. It was not possible that the enemy, who searched the five parts of the world to find agents, would leave untouched one with these exceptional qualities. And when, after 2 years of war, the woman Zell entered into the office of Captain Ladeau, it was certain that she was no virgin in espionage matters, end quote. He called her an unashamed whore and a woman, quote, without scruples, unaccustomed to making use of men, she is the type of woman who is born to be a spy, end quote. The first word that pops in my head about Bouchardon is, what an asshole. First of all, it sounds like he is, like, totally, like, wants to bang her, of course, because he's talking about all these great qualities, then he calls her a whore, you know, it's like, so basically, yes, her lifestyle, who she was, is really what gets her convicted here. She did, by the way, admit to taking money from the Germans, but she said it was compensation for the stuff they had taken from her at the beginning of the war. Bouchardon said she was actually admitting to spying. She never did, by the way, admit to spying. She, you know, maintained her innocence till the end. Unfortunately for her also, all her lovers, the famous and the infamous, disengaged from her. Even Vadim denied the engagements and renounced her. So, brokenhearted also. What's worse, her defense counsel, Edouard Clunet, was denied permission to cross-examine witnesses or examine his own witnesses directly. So they were done with her from the very beginning. She was already condemned before she even went on this trial. So Maude Hari was found guilty on 8 counts of espionage and sentenced to death by firing squad. October 1917, Maude Hari, who was 41 years old, was not bound. who had refused a blindfold, who blew a kiss to the 12 French soldiers aiming guns at her heart, was shot for being a spy. Henry Wales, a British reporter who was at the execution, reported, quote, "Slowly, inertly, she settled to her knees." This is after she was shot, by the way. "Her head up always and without the slightest change of expression on her face. For the fraction of a second, it seemed she tottered there, on her knees, gazing directly at those who had taken her life. Then she fell backward, bending at the waist, with her legs doubled up beneath her. A non-commissioned officer walked up to her body and shot her in the head with his revolver to make sure she was dead. Her body was used for medical study. Her head was embalmed and kept in the Museum of Anatomy in Paris, but it disappeared as early as 1954, but wasn't discovered missing until 2000 when the museum was being relocated. So, of course, you know, her head... It's so weird to me. She's another celebrity that's missing a body part that was in the museum. So somebody took Mata Hari's head. Whoever you are, why? Why? Just give it back. I don't know why they have it in the Museum of Anatomy in Paris anyway. That's kind of weird to me, okay? But, you know, why would you steal it? Or maybe it was in its jar and somebody dropped it and it broke and they just threw it away. I don't know. I'm speculating here. Anyway, so Mata Hari, is she a victim? Was she really a spy? It's probable. Was she like all in? Like she knew she was a spy, like a lot of the other, you know, women that we will eventually talk about as far as being spies? I don't know. That's the part that makes me wonder. You know, she needed money, true. She also liked a lot of attention and glamour. She probably thought she was very smart, so she could, you know, work both things, and it was all harmless anyway. She wasn't, again, in her mind, she for sure wasn't giving them any information they couldn't read in the papers. So, in her mind, maybe it was harmless. So I don't know. I don't know. Either way, she is considered a woman committing a crime. And now, for some feedback. Thanks for holding on to the end. I want to give a shout out to MICH1108, who wrote on February 7th, 2022, quote, "Great show, really great listen and fun because she's down to earth and does great research," end quote. Thank you so much, MICH1108, for the 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. I really appreciate the kind words and encouragement. And from Kristen683, who wrote on April 1st, 2022, which I'm going to assume is not an April Fool's post. Anyway, quote, "Love that you're down to earth. Amazing choices. I like that it's a different choice of people. Love your style," end quote. Thanks, Kristen683. I try to make the choices as diverse as possible. You know, the different crimes, the different types of women. And thank you also for the kind words and encouragement. I love both of these. And there weren't any negative reviews. Thank you so much. I do appreciate from both listeners that I'm also down to earth. That was my goal, you know, to be informative in a casual conversational way. And I really do love all the feedback, the great, the not so great. They all help me make the podcast better. If any of you have an idea or feedback, please email me at womencommittingcrimes@gmail.com or tweet @crimeswomen or join the Women Committing Crimes Facebook page or go to the website womencommittingcrimes.com. Well, you're where you'll find a list of women that you can pick from, or if you know of a WCC, let me know and I'll take it on. I promise. That's what Carla Homolka was a reviewer's. I got an email, and that one was from a listener. So, and that one was great. I hadn't even thought about that one. So that one was so gross. If you don't know what I'm talking about, please listen to it. It's God, she's terrible, and I know she's out there. So fuck you, Carla. Anyway, now for the other thank yous. Thank you to my wonderful and loving husband, Doug, who designed the logos for this podcast, as well as the podcast Off Kilter No Filter. So, Off Kilter No Filter is a podcast about anything and everything with me and Byron Alexander. Check it out wherever you listen to podcasts. It comes out whenever it comes out. We took a hiatus because he's for school purposes, but come listen to these podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and any other podcaster you use. Make sure to give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. That's the one that's like the most popular. Favorite us on iHeartRadio. I'm on there too. Or whatever podcast you use. Also, thank you to Byron Alexander for the movie for this podcast. Music. Oh my God. It's been a while. I'm kind of flubbing this today. It's been a while since I've recorded. So, Byron Alexander, thank you for the mo- I almost did it again. Music for this podcast. The intro song is Forgive Me, and the outro song is Who, both on Byron's amazing album, Square One. There's a link for it in the description. I'm hoping to remember to do that. And if you like a little preview of the dynamic of Byron and Tammy in Off Kilter No Filter, make sure to listen to the Martha Stewart episode. He's my first and only guest so far, so I'm going to try to see if I can't get a guest here and there. We have lots of guests on the Off Kilter No Filter podcast. My husband's on there, my son, my daughter, Byron's, we have other people too, his sister. And so, you know, please come listen to that. And now for next time. I'm hoping it will be the first week of July, but goddamn. Whenever I give a time limit, I never make it. I don't know why. Well, because life happens. This summer is going to be crazy also. My brother's getting married, so I got tons of family coming in, and I'm kind of being like the wedding planner for it. And then I'm going to the West Coast to visit my daughter, and then my husband and I and our son are going to Florida. For another week. And then, you know, August 1st, I go back to work. God damn. But it'll be my last year teaching, so I'm extremely excited about that before I retire from teaching. Not from life. I'm going to have to get like 5 jobs to replace it, but I'm over this teaching, and you could probably guess why. And if you can't, where have you been? Anyway, so the person I'm going to do next is Rosemary West. She is an English serial killer who collaborated with her husband Fred West in the torture and murder of at least 9 young women between 1973 and 1987. Last I heard, she's still in prison, so maybe still a live one. So, see you next time. I missed you all. Can't wait to talk again. Bye.